Anthony Lowenstein is a Jerusalem-based Australian journalist whose work has featured in a host of publications, including the Washington Post, BBC, and New York Times. His new book, Pills, Powder and Smoke, Inside the Bloody War on Drugs, sees him travel across the globe investigating individuals, officials, activists, DEA agents, and traffickers caught up in the grisly multi-billion dollar industry. And he joins us now. Anthony Lowenstein, welcome to Breakfasters.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Pleasure. Now, where and how long did this investigation take you? What were you looking for?
So I've done this book for about 5 years, and I travelled over that time to a number of countries, Honduras, Guinea-Bissau, which is in West Africa, Philippines, US, UK, Australia. And in the first three places particularly, I was looking at, A, in Honduras, the majority of cocaine going into the US goes via Honduras from Colombia and Venezuela. And the use of cocaine in the US and Australia is insane. Massive, growing, popular. Obviously in Australia, cocaine is pretty expensive. In the US, it's much cheaper. But the fact that you have so much cocaine going into the US and there's so much demand, it means it has to get there somehow. And the coca plant's not being grown in the US. It's being grown in South America. So Honduras has become this apocalyptic landscape where violence is out of control, has one of the highest murder rates in the world outside a traditional war zone. And I was there interviewing a lot of people who not just were caught up in the drug war, but whose lives were a misery. So, for example, there's something in Honduras called a war tax, which is also happening in other nearby countries. So if you want to start a business, whether it's a stall on the side of the road, a shop, whatever, you have to pay one gang, two gangs, three gangs a weekly fee. And if you don't, they will shoot you dead. It is literally as simple as that. I've seen footage of bus drivers who didn't pay a fee. A gang member comes on the bus while it's driving and they're shot dead. Mm. And, yes, people mostly survive on the bus, in case people are wondering, but this is the daily reality for people. And the fact that a massive demand for drugs almost guarantees that it'd be an incredibly ugly trafficking route, and which is why I'm calling for legalizing all drugs that we can get to. Anyway, Guinea-Bissau, West Africa, most cocaine going to Europe goes via this West African country, to transit country. And Philippines, as some listeners will be aware, has had a very, very brutal drug war in the last 2.5 years with Rodrigo Duterte, the president. There's probably been around 30,000 people murdered, mostly by police and vigilantes in that time. These are low-level drug users, mostly taking something called shabu, which is an methamphetamine. And people are taking it there mostly for, in my view, very good reasons. Not that I think people should be taking those drugs, but life there is bloody hard. And to get through the day, to do manual labor, to be a sex worker, whatever your life is there, I'm talking about people who are poor, but the war on drugs there and everywhere I've looked at really is a war on the poor. It always has been. And in the Philippines and everywhere else, rarely are high-level drug dealers gone after. The drug war was never about that. Yes, you do see in the media now and then high-level drug leaders or cartels imprisoned. For sure, it happens. But the majority of cases, what the drug war, and this is what I try to examine in the book, including here in Australia, has always been a way to control the drug market from the government's perspective rather than to try to end drug use. I mean, Australians have one of the highest per capita drug uses in the world. We spend roughly, last year, $10 billion on illegal drugs. Illegal meaning cannabis, coke, ice, heroin, huge amounts of money. And my view is, I've got no problem with people taking drugs. I think it should be a legalized and regulated system rather than an illegal one. But when you make it illegal, you don't know what you're taking. And often that's the problem, that we have a system here where growing numbers of the population are using drugs. It's a normal part of life. Most people who take drugs have no trouble with it. They use it regularly, daily, parties, whatever it is. Mm. There's a minority of people who have problems with drugs for a range of reasons, family breakdowns, crisis, and that those people need to be assisted, to be sure. But when you criminalize drug use, and I would say often drug users, then you almost guarantee an incredibly unhealthy reality for those kinds of people in society. And so the law, in my view, hasn't caught up with public opinion. So It's been a five-year, pretty heavy journey.
Yeah. And Nixon coined the term?
Nixon coined the term. So I talk about this in the book. The drug war has been going on for arguably 100 years, and often it was really started as a basis for deep racism. So in the US, for example, Mexicans were coming into the US. about 100 or so years ago, a bit more than that. And the white population and media would frame it as these Mexicans are coming in and going to be seducing our white women and using opium to do so. We have to control these people and these drugs. In Australia, it was the fear of Chinese apparently coming to seduce white women. There's a theme here, right? The sense that our women, so to speak, are being defiled by these outsiders. And you fast forward 100 years, and maybe now we're not going after the Chinese so much, although we're still going after the Mexicans in the US. Trump is, certainly. But you still see a demonization of certain kinds of drugs and the people who are using them. So the drug war was coined by Nixon in the early 70s. And it's been really continued successfully by virtually every president. Obama was the only president, and I discuss this in the book, who to some extent tried to moderate the drug war domestically and globally. But in the end, we now have a Donald Trump as president. He may well win next year, God help us. And those very hardline policies will continue. But the only there is some hope. In the US, for example, now pretty much all the leading Democratic candidates for president for 2020 advocate legalizing cannabis, reparations for communities that suffered because of the drug war. That's normally people of color, African Americans, Latinos, and huge investment in those communities and allowing those people, if they want to get involved in the cannabis industry legally, to do so, to make, you know, to make money or whatever they want to do. So that is a shift that didn't happen in 2016 with the election, and is happening next year. Now the Democrats might lose. Sure, we don't know, but there is a societal shift, and public opinion in the US shows that the majority of Americans support legalizing marijuana, and there's a growing acceptance in the US and here that large numbers of people now are aware that using psychedelic drugs, talking about ecstasy, LSD, magic mushrooms, putting aside people enjoying it just at a party, and that I've got no problem with that, but putting that issue aside for medicinal reasons. So there's huge evidence now, and Johns Hopkins University in the US just, in fact, recently announced the world's biggest center for studies of psychedelic drugs to look at people who might be depressed or on PTSD, or people who are near the end of their life. And the studies have shown that people could be using some of these kinds of drugs in controlled environments to manage those problems. The results are amazing. So it's almost like when you have lovely, nice, middle-class people using some kinds of drugs, it becomes far more societally accepted. And not that everyone has to be middle-class to use those drugs, of course, but that's often the way that it's framed in our society. So I think although those drugs, ecstasy remains illegal, and it's hard to see ecstasy, for example, being legal in Australia next week, that's true. But you'd be amazed how US, despite being an incredibly brutal society around drugs, is far more open at some levels to imagining a doctor prescribing you ecstasy and a therapist using those drugs to help you. I mean, that is a very possible, viable reality within 5 or 10 years. And in Australia, although maybe it's a bit further behind, that's happening already now. There are doctors in Melbourne, therapists using these drugs with patients. They're not going to announce it probably because they're worried they might get raided by the police, but this is happening. And these drugs have been around for decades, and yet it's only now that we're finally seeing respectable scientific studies showing that they can actually also have medicinal purposes, like with cannabis. So that to me is a positive shift.
Talking about the narrative of drugs, you know, the media certainly portrays that, you know, that there isn't a lot of drug taking. And I think a lot more people take drugs than the media would portray. And then there's the narrative around, you know, certainly more people are taking cocaine than they would be taking ice, yet there is an ice epidemic.
Yes.
So what do we do to change the narrative around that?
One of the things I talk about in the book is how, and I'm obviously a journalist, so I'm in the media, but I often loathe my own profession because too often in Australia, a lot of countries, and this includes the ABC, it's not just the tabloids, in Melbourne, the Herald Sun or whatever, it's a lot of media, routinely allow the police to essentially publish a press release. So we've all seen stories, including on ABC, we've got the biggest ice bust ever, we've got the biggest cocaine bust ever, and you go, okay, great, and what? And so what? And what's your point? What's the story here? That yes, you're getting a lot of ice or cocaine. Okay, does that have any impact on supply?
I like
or
how
use?
They deliver the like a cat delivering a bird to the front doorstep.
Yes,
here's this giant pile of drugs
for sure. Yeah. And again, I mean, I think a legalized, regulated system should go after violent drug cartels. I'm not saying we should cut all those people off and they're very awful human beings. But the problem is that those stories often are published or broadcast as somehow showing what? We're fighting the drug war. Any police you speak to, and this includes people I've spoken to, mostly off the record, Mick Palmer, who used to run the Australian Federal Police, hardly a radical lefty, worked under John Howard mostly. I was doing an event with him recently at Melbourne Town Hall. He says, we knew when we were running the AFP, and even now more so, that the drug war was lost. Everyone knows it. We're making no impact on supply, no matter how many shipments we get of ice or whatever. So I think it's changing public opinion by partly showing that not everyone who takes drugs somehow is lying in the street dying. Those people exist, and I'm not minimizing that we shouldn't provide far more support to those people, but that too often the people who are dying from drugs, bad ecstasy pills or whatever, are getting it because we don't know what's in them, or heroin, whatever it may be. So a legalized, regulated system in Australia, you would know what's in the drugs. They wouldn't be simply available, you know, heroin next to your veggies at the supermarket. That's obvious, but let me just say that. Yeah. It would be available potentially via a doctor or via a pharmacy. Cannabis would be more available for sure. And one of the problems, as some listeners will be aware, is that often cannabis these days, this synthetic cannabis, there can be really strong, I would say unhealthily strong cannabis that exists out there and can often screw people up. And in a regulated system, I'm not saying that would not be available, but it'd be far less likely to be around because a regulated system would only, whether cannabis is produced by the state or a accepted private company, you would know what's in the drug, you know what's likely to happen. And that'd be the same with cocaine or heroin as well. So yes, there's no doubt that a lot of media has a lot to answer for, but I do think that there is, we need to just keep on reminding people, and public opinion also is out there, that at the moment, as I said, you have a lot of people taking drugs. So there might be that media saying all these awful things about these apparently terrible people taking drugs. But the reality is a lot of people are using it anyway. They're ignoring those kind of messages. So politicians, I think, are as often. This is across the board, by the way. It's not particularly against the federal Liberal government who are, yes, are fairly draconian. Federal Labor ain't that much better.
Mm. Do you think the ethics of where our drugs come from plays a part in this? Because more than ever before, we are conscious of where our coffee comes from, our chocolate comes from, yet we don't ask where our cocaine comes from on the weekend.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, yes, in a word, absolutely. And this is one of the things I talk about in the book, and I, when I get a chance, advocate. There should be a real movement around ethically sourced cocaine. Now, what that means clearly is that at the moment, as you rightly say, people are so passionate, I'm sure particularly Triple R listeners, of where their food comes from and maybe their shoes if they're vegan, whatever. And that's great. Go for it, guys. But why aren't we asking questions about where our drugs are coming from? Cocaine is not being grown in Australia. And one of the reasons I went to some of these places overseas was to say, these are the people who are suffering for our pleasure. I mean, that's the reality. And they're not benefiting from wonderfully lovely cocaine. They're not. And an ethically sourced cocaine would mean that everybody along the supply chain, from the farmer to everyone else, would be supported and given a decent wage. Now, at the moment, it's hard to imagine that, I acknowledge, because cocaine is illegal. But in the recent global drug survey, which is the world's biggest drug survey, 130,000 people around the world are interviewed roughly every year online. And this year, for the first time, it comes out of the UK, but a lot of Aussies answer questions about this as well. First time ever, the question was asked, would you be interested in ethically sourced cocaine? Majority by far said yes. Would you be willing to pay more for that? The majority said yes. How much? 25% more. Wow. Now, some people might say, well, you're never going to have a legalized cocaine market in Australia. Sure, it sounds maybe right now at least quite odd. But I do think thinking far more about where our drugs come from is a reasonable thing to do when drugs are being consumed in Australia at an unbelievably high rate, even though cocaine, from what I understand, is at least $300 a gram. It's hardly a poor person's drug. It's expensive. In the UK, it's way, way cheaper. And, of course, in South America, it's, you know, a couple of dollars. So Australians, at least some, mostly middle class, I guess, with that amount of money, are spending a lot of money on coke. And I suspect most of them ain't thinking that much where it's coming from, including here in Melbourne, and they should.
Can you speak a little bit about the logistics of putting a book like this together, the fixes that you must enlist, the safety, the communication constraints? How vulnerable are you in a project like this?
You feel vulnerable. I mean, in places like Honduras, it's, as I said, a very violent country. I had local fixers, for those who don't know, is a local journalist that foreign journalists will pay to help you get around. You pay them a daily fee. I spent months trying to find someone who I could trust, because when you're on the ground there, you really, to some extent, are in their hands. I spoke to other journalists who had been to Honduras, asked them who to recommend. And I did this also when I'd been to places like Afghanistan a number of times, where, and Afghanistan was scarier, but Honduras particularly was the scariest place for this book, because you felt vulnerable and exposed. There wasn't so much the threat there as there is in Afghanistan, save a suicide bombing at a cafe or, you know, Islamist violence. So that doesn't really exist there, sort of Muslim extremism. But what does exist is absolutely rampant police corruption and violence and a culture of impunity. So there are a number of times where I was with my local fixer. We're driving around. We get pulled over by the police. They draw their weapons. They didn't put guns to our heads, but it's a deeply threatening environment. Now, did I think I was going to die? I didn't feel like I was about to die, but the number of times where I thought, this is not looking that great. But at the same time, I want to say that I don't want to portray myself as, you know, I'm the crusading hero journalist. I mean, yes, I went to these places and, yes, I write about them. And I was just in Nigeria a few months ago doing a film for Al Jazeera. And we went to Boko Haram territory in the north, looking at the massive use of opioid drugs like tramadol, which is a legal drug, which is available here, which is being abused in Nigeria, one of the worst in the world, and it's fueling the insurgency. And you go up to these places, and it's scary, to be sure. But the people who are suffering the most are not the journalists, as in the foreign journalists. We can leave, and we do leave. We visit there. We, in my view, I always treat people with respect, and as a journalist, unlike, I think, too many others often who don't give credit to local journalists on the ground, without whom you would not be going to these places and getting access to them. I thank them in the book. I'm in regular contact with them. They are often they're much more exposed than we are as Westerners, and I think that should be credited.
And from Honduras to somewhere a little more sedate, Canberra, what do you see coming out of Canberra, the drug testing for welfare recipients, even in the ACT, pill testing? What's your handle on the Australian domestic situation?
So domestically, ACT probably is the most progressive state on drugs in the country, has been for a long time. As you rightly say, in the last year and a half, they've had two official drug pill testing events at music festivals, supported by the police and the government, and the evidence for that is overwhelmingly successful. Bad pills were found, ecstasy pills. No one died. Those pills were thrown away. And there was education given that, you know, bring your pills to us, we'll test them, and if they're bad, we'll get rid of them. I mean, that is a logical system. And in my view, there should be government mandated. It should be illegal not to have pill testing. And I'm very disappointed that your premier in Victoria, who finally did come around to a safety injecting facility, frankly took him far too long, is weirdly, completely, ignorantly saying he refuses to accept pill testing. The evidence is overwhelming for that, and Victoria should introduce that yesterday. It's insane. Canberra, federally speaking, is a less pretty picture. Yes, welfare, the idea of drug testing welfare recipients is a draconian policy. It doesn't work. It often makes people go further into poverty and depression. Nowhere in the world this has worked. And it's disappointing, although unsurprising, the federal government's trying to do this. I think the next logical, likely step, I sort of compare this to, there needs to be a kind of like the same-sex marriage campaign in Australia. We can argue about whether the plebiscite was the right way to do it, and that's a different argument, but that was the decision the government made, and there was a vote. Okay. Majority of Australians said, yes, we support same-sex marriage. It's now legal. I'm not saying the system is now perfect, but it's a legal thing. And I think that there needs to be a similarly large campaign for legalising cannabis and pill testing. And politicians could still ignore it, but I do think that that sort of sheer numbers of people makes it difficult, particularly for some maybe on the Labor side, to ignore it. Right now, Labor doesn't want to go there. Talk about drugs, ignore drugs, take drugs, smoke drugs, snort drugs. No one wants to go there. And it'd be nice and honest if a number of politicians and judges and others who are involved in this issue, I want to see a public campaign of those people saying our drug laws are insane, A, but B, we've taken drugs. I use drugs. My kid uses ecstasy and he or she is fine, or even if they're not fine. Let's have a lot more honesty in the drug debate, because without that, people are going to keep on dying.
All right. Well, Pills, Powder and Smoke Inside the Bloody War on Drugs is Andy Lowenstein's contribution to the debate. It's out now through Scribe. And thank you so very much for coming in.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.